Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
As you sat down to dinner this evening, I wonder whether you gave much thought to what you were eating and how it might affect your health. I guess in general terms we do, but what about your gut health? The food that's making its way through your system now will impact your immunity, your metabolism, even your brain function. In the past few years, there's been an increasing awareness about the importance of healthy gut function in maintaining a healthy body and mind. So tonight on the show, we're talking guts. A new book, The CSIRO Healthy Gut Diet, digs deep down what we need and what can go wrong. And two of the authors of The CSIRO Healthy Gut Diet are with us this evening. Dr. Michael Condon is a senior research scientist at CSIRO's Health and Security. And Penny Taylor is a senior research scientist at the CSIRO as well. And they've joined us in the studio this evening. Michael and Penny, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening.
Great to have you with us. When we talk about the gut, what actually do we mean, Penny?
Well, when we're talking about the gut, we're talking about different segments of the gut in this book, and it basically comes from when you're actually starting to eat, the mouth right through to the stomach and onto the end.
Okay. So, you can think of it as just a one long tube, could you?
That has many
highways and byways along the way.
It does. I mean, our gut is quite unique. It houses a lot of microbiota, as you talked about it, but it does a lot of other functions as well. So, you know, as you start eating food, there's simple enzymes in the mouth that start to break down carbohydrates, for example, so amylase. And then as it goes through the gut, it goes through in a circular motion and starts churning our food to, you know, take out nutrients, water, and through to the gut itself or the stomach. And right through to the bowel, where it just takes out more nutrients and absorption of water as well. So it's really quite a complex organ.
Yeah. Michael, you could take us on a little journey with a ham sandwich.
All right. As Penny's sort of given a very rough description of what goes on in the gut, certainly the upper gut, there's probably obviously the first part is the mouth, where you're obviously trying to, I guess, break down into small pieces a lot of the food, and there are enzymes there that help to break it down.
That's the demolition part, is it?
It's the demolition part of it.
The mouth. Yeah.
And then we get through to the stomach, where you've got that acidic environment where you really do the hard work of breaking a lot of the food down into its various molecules, gets through to the small intestine where a lot of the...
Before we get there,
yeah,
on
sure.
The way down between the mouth and the stomach...
Mm-hmm.
Does anything happen, or that's just the laundry chute, is it?
It's pretty much the laundry chute. There could be things happening there. That's an interesting point, but I think largely it's just it's the laundry chute, as you kind of put it.
Yeah, because I've often thought, you know, sometimes if we're always told as kids, there's often some sense behind these. Behind childhood wisdom, we're always told to chew your food properly. And in fact, there have been various points, haven't there, when people have gone through obsessive behaviours about chewing. But we were told, you know, don't bolt your food, chew it properly.
That's true.
Why is that necessary? Because after all, if you accidentally swallow a piece of unchewed food, it doesn't seem to make a lot of difference, does it?
Well, I suppose there is some sort of risk of, particularly as you age, actually, it gets harder and harder to swallow food. And so certainly chewing it actually gets the food into smaller pieces, and there's less risk of problems of getting food lodged as it goes down into the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
But there's certainly enzymes in the mouth that help to that initial digestion process. So the longer you have it in the mouth with the salivary enzymes, it just helps that whole digestion process.
Okay, so it gets into the stomach. And now this is a kind of very, very fancy recycling centre indeed, isn't it?
Well, it's really heavy, as it's an acidic environment where really it just basically tries to dissolve as much of the food, if you like, and break it down into its constituent molecules, so that's much easier for the body to absorb some of the essential nutrients when it gets through into the small intestine.
So by the time the sandwiches come out of the stomach, it's in purely liquid form, is it?
Largely, yep. and that helps the small intestine to absorb the nutrients that are present.
Okay, so once it, it comes out of the stomach, is the liquid that comes out of the stomach of the same highly acidic form that the stomach is?
That's right. It's fairly acidic once it comes out. It's in that form, and then it gradually becomes neutralized and changes pH as it goes further down through the rest of the intestine.
Okay, and so what the small intestine, all the good stuff gets extracted.
Well, not all of the good stuff. So a lot of the sugars and the readily digested components actually get absorbed into the small intestine. That's where most of the nutrients get taken up.
Uh-huh.
But one of the key factors that we want to talk about in our book is that it's important to actually get a lot of the fibers and some of the undigested carbohydrates into the large bowel, because the large bowel actually requires energy, and it gets that from the fermentation of some of the complex carbohydrates that get down there.
Okay, so the large bowel, that's, I mean, we, the more we know about it, the more complicated it seems to be, doesn't it? It's it obviously is involved in removing water and compacting the mass for discharge at the back end. But it's also, of course, got this huge role in terms of the gut microbiota, doesn't it?
Most of the microbes are present there. Some estimates say you've got as many cells in the large microbial cells as you do in the rest of your body. Could be even more.
Really?
Yeah. And it's more or less than actually compacting what's there. It's actually about actually expanding it, because those microbes actually grow and in response to the food that gets down there. And so you actually get an increase, or you get a stool bulk increase together with some of the water holding capacity of some of the fibers that get down there. So you actually increase the bulk of the food, and that actually helps to move the food along, and it's good for your health.
Mm. Penny, I mean, we've known kind of forever, haven't we, that there's a link between gut function and health. What do we think that link is now? We think it's much more important than maybe we first thought, don't we?
I think so. I think we've always known that the gut is really important in aiding digestion and absorption, as Michael just explained. But what we're starting to learn is more about the microbial action, and more importantly, how we can actually feed the microbial environment to produce, you know, good bacteria and make our health and wellbeing much more enjoyable, I guess. So, you know, again, coming back to the book, what we're focusing on is the resistant starch within our fibres that can actually feed that good gut bacteria and, I guess, produce more of the good fatty acids, so the butyrate kind of production in the large bowel.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us some more about this, what this gut microbiota means. I mean, you say there are as many cells down there as maybe in the cells in the rest of our body that are inhabiting the large bowel. What are they doing?
Well, I'm going to pass that one over to Michael, because he's our legendary gut scientist.
All right. So, look, we actually don't understand what all the microbes are doing down there, to be honest. We do, because, I mean, it's really in the last few decades where technology has actually enabled us to actually work out what's there. Previously, we relied on culturing those microbes, but they're incredibly hard to culture.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're finding is that a lot of those microbes in the large bowel in particular are there to help to break down and ferment the complex carbohydrates that we get in many of our plant foods. But there are microbes that carry out all sorts of other functions. I mean, they produce vitamins. They're involved in some of the fat metabolism, bile acid turnover. They help to degrade compounds we call polyphenols that might get down there. Look, that they carry out a whole range of different functions and produce substances that are important for the rest of the body.
Mm. Okay, so it's very important. A healthy gut, when we talk about a healthy gut, we're talking about a gut that has a healthy balance of these microbes. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, but we actually don't understand exactly what a healthy gut microbiota population really is. We've got a rough idea, and we certainly know some of the microbes that we would normally associate with health. But every person actually has a completely different fingerprint, if you like, of gut microbiota populations.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to work out you know, amongst that variation, what is normal and what is not is still one of the challenges that we face.
Right. I mean, presumably it's self-regulating, though, isn't it? I mean, how does it get out of whack?
Penny, you might want to...
I guess one of the major causes of a poor gut environment is our diet. And coming back to, you know, our diet quality in Australia is not where it needs to be. It is improving. We're eating more fibre than we have in the past, but we're still not getting enough. So diets that are high in saturated fat, the sugars, the typical foods that we know are to be the indulgence foods, mm-hmm. can cause an unhealthy environment for our bacteria, and we can produce more negative bacteria, which can lead on to, a leaky gut in the future, obviously obesity as well.
What's a leaky gut?
Well, a leaky gut is basically, so our gut cells are made up of tight junctions, and when there's a slight inflammation in those tight junctions, they start to separate. And the food that would normally stay within the stomach for digestion can actually leak out into the systemic region, so the outer region of the gut.
What, leak out through your gut?
Leak out through the gut tissue.
Really?
Yeah.
What, so really, I didn't think that was possible.
Yeah. So actually a lot of the toxins, a lot of the microbes can actually get into the bloodstream, and that in a sense can lead to the inflammation in those areas.
So where do they leak out through? What, leak out through the stomach lining or leak out through the intestinal lining, do they?
Yeah, so that those cells that line the gut, they need to have tight, so no gaps between the cells, and so under certain dietary conditions when those gaps start to widen. So it's not like that's the best way of explaining it, I think. It's mm-hmm. just a general leakiness or less tightness of between those cells.
Okay. Why is fibre important?
Well, the fibre itself, I mean, we've got two different types of fibre. It's insoluble and soluble, and resistance starch is part of the soluble fibre. So it's important for feeding our gut. So we know that fibre is really important for bulking our bowel actions, if we can talk about this time of night.
Yeah, of course.
But we also know that resistant starch is resistant because it actually makes it to the large intestine for fermentation. And it's that resistant starch that actually goes into the bowel and feeds the good bacteria. So we're producing more of the good bacteria in that environment.
Okay. My texter says, when you flush your gut for colonoscopy, do you lose all the gut flora?
So that's always been, you know, one of the unknowns. So it's unlikely that you lose all of your gut flora. We know that they're sort of most of the populations, or at least a typical number of microbes, are still present along the cell walls, mm-hmm. along the lining of the gut. So they're still there. The main problem is probably when people have antibiotics, where they're actually killing a lot of the microbes that are present. And so often your microbial population will come back as it was before, but there's a reasonable chance that you have a different set of microbes or combination of microbes after that event.
Yeah, I mean, people often talk about this, don't they? Particularly when you take some quite, you know, broad-spectrum antibiotics.
Absolutely.
That it might act as, you know, as something of a carpet bombing effect down there.
Yeah, that's right. So it's probably, I mean, obviously antibiotics have their role to play, but it's certainly, you want to think twice about whether you really need them, just given the devastation that it could potentially have on your gut in particular.
Hmm. Yeah. There's fibre and fibre, isn't there? What actually is fibre anyway?
Well, fibre basically is indigestible components that get largely from plant origin that get down to the large bowel, so they're not digested. It's the simplest term.
Okay, and so tell me again why it's important to have food that can't be digested.
So when it comes to those indigestible plant components, mm-hmm. so the fibres carry out a range of different functions. Firstly, they have that bulking effect. So a lot of things like cellulose, it doesn't ferment, it doesn't break down at all, and basically it helps to carry food through the whole system. But it also has that water holding capacity, which helps to create the bulk. But then you have the things which can ferment. There's the soluble fibres, and particular resistant starch, which have varying degrees of fermentability, and it's the fermentation that's really important for a lot of the gut health, because it's some of those fermentation products which, one, they're the energy for a lot of the cells that line the gut, but they're also carrying out a whole range of other functions. They help to protect the cells against DNA damage. They have a lot of other biological functions, and they can also get into the bloodstream where they can carry out effects as well.
Okay. Michael Conlon is with us, and Penny Taylor from the CSIRO Healthy Gut Diet book, and we're talking about the gut, the importance of eating properly for your gut, and the, of course, big link we now believe exists between the gut and the brain. How important is that link?
So it's an emerging area. I think there's certainly been a number of studies over recent years which suggest that certain microbes can influence mood, can potentially influence behaviour. There's some suggestion of changes in the gut microbiota in people with autism spectrum disorder, for example. Plus, I mean, we recognise that the brain and the gut are linked. So we have nerves that come down to the gut from the brain, the vagal nerve, and we know there's bidirectional communication going on. So your mood can affect the gut. So people who are stressed out, for example, it's well known that people can get stomach upsets if they're too stressed out. And similarly, if there's something's going on in the gut, it can feed back to the brain and affect your mood.
Okay, so getting this bacterial population, massive population, in the right balance, a balance we don't quite understand, is important for all those sorts of things. I mean, our sense of well-being, our sense of emotional stability, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, as we understand more and more, we're seeing that what goes on in the gut can affect not only the brain but a whole range of different functions throughout the whole body.
Mm. Penny, why this current fad for kombucha and other fermented drinks? What's that all about?
I guess the belief about kombucha is that it's a fermentable food and it carries in bacteria to the gut, so it can actually replenish the gut bacteria. I guess one of the things about kombucha is that it's like fermented foods, such as your kimchi or sauerkraut, for example. People are striving because there's a lot of, about 50% of Australians are actually suffering from some gut disorder. So people are striving for some product or some outcome that can actually help them feel better. And I guess that's why we've actually thought, you know, we need to get into this space of actually informing people about the gut. So the book is actually designed to inform people about the gut and then go into teaching people how to use foods that are beneficial for their gut health that feed the microbiota. So
just talking about fermented the fermented drinks that are popular at the moment, a fermented food is important. Why? Because fermented food contains more bacteria than unfermented food. Is that it?
Look, there's not enough evidence around fermented foods to say that they're actually beneficial in that way at the moment.
Right.
There needs to be more evidence or research in that area to, I guess, validate that.
At the moment that fad, that fashion is not based on any hard science.
Not any hard science, no, but people may feel better for it and it may be suitable to them. So that's the area we're not clear on, and that's where the evidence is needed, is to understand, you know, what is the gut microbiota for each individual and the individual variation, what does work for another person may not work for somebody else. So we know one diet doesn't fit everybody or one product doesn't fit everybody. We do understand that these things may be of benefit for an individual, but if you are striving for those products because you are getting some gut issues or some, you know, just poorly digestible foods and getting some bloating, that we do speak to your GP or your health professional about those.
My guests tonight are Dr. Michael Conlon and Penny Taylor from the CSIRO Healthy Gut Diet book. We're talking about the gut, a healthy gut, and what constitutes it, what you could do to improve things for you. What about this issue of gluten sensitivity, Michael and Penny? This seems to be on everywhere you go these days, but foods are designated as, you know, gluten-free or not gluten-free. What's that all about?
Sure. I guess when we first look at gluten sensitivity, we think of celiacs, which is only about 5% of the population, and they're the ones that really need to avoid gluten. We don't cover that off in the book, but the gluten intolerance is a different story. There's a belief that some people may be intolerant to gluten or wheat, and that may be causing some of the upset in the stomach, because you got parts of that may be not really well digested in the gut, causing a bit of bloating or discomfort. So I guess people do go towards, again, it's like kombucha or a lot of fermented foods. There's a need for somebody to go towards an option that's going to actually make them feel better. So gluten and lactose-free is one of those types of environments that, or dietary choices that people make in the desperate attempt to try and feel better. We tend to, I guess, recognise those symptoms, and they are real symptoms and not things to be ignored. And if you are striving towards a gluten-free diet because of bloating or and it's not diagnosed, it's really important to get that diagnosed, because you could be masking something just by cutting those foods out.
Mm. Okay. All right. Let's take some calls. Robert's from North Rocks. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, g'day. How are you going?
Not bad.
And hi, it's Dr. Michael and Penny. Look, something you mentioned earlier, I just want to know a little bit more about. You're talking about fibre and green material. I'm just wondering if blending up some of your things like kale and celery, blending that stuff up in a smoothie, are you losing some of the benefits by blending it too finely? Are you better off still having it as a very coarse sort of smoothie?
Yeah, that's a fair enough question.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Generally, we say, you know, if you can have the fibre or the whole foods intact, that's the best way to have it. So, you know, avoiding the blending down. But, you know, blending down fruit and vegetables is a great way to have a bit of a fibre boost in the day. So, you know, the priority is what's in your day, what's your time consist of, and definitely, you know, first preference, eat the whole food. But, you know, having those foods into a smoothie, for example, in the morning when people are quite busy, and having it in the car on the run is quite beneficial.
Yeah. I mean, does it really make much difference, Michael? Because by the time it comes out of the stomach, the kale is in a very blended form, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some structure does sort of keep its form as it goes down. So I think, yeah, some, if at all possible, try to keep as much of the structure as possible. But, yeah, look, I mean, it's not... I don't think there's a balance there. I mean, it's easy to, it's a good thing also to get, as Penny said, to get some of the, making sure you get the components into your diet rather than the original structure.
Yeah. And one of the things with fibre as well is that it's actually a bulking agent. So looking at what you're actually looking for, if it's made into a liquid, you may feel hungrier sooner because it does empty a lot faster from the stomach. So again, like Michael said, going for the whole foods and the components that are going to be quite bulky are great. But if you're time poor, having a blended shake on the run is perfect.
Mm. Well, I think maybe a coarser blend. So maybe not just blend it to a inch of its life. Maybe this may be the solution there.
That's a pretty good solution.
On you, Robert. Thanks, mate.
All right,
bye bye. Karen from Sunshine. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. I get very bad indigestion after eating foods with herbs or spices in it, particularly curries. And I was wondering what I could do about it. And even things like mashed potato, you know, it really affects me. And I get it's quite painful, the indigestion.
Michael?
Okay. So, look, I mean, yeah, I think curries and spices actually, you know, are a reasonably common complaint. A lot of people are quite sensitive to those type of foods, and in particular people if they have things like ulcerative colitis, that can be a real trigger for those conditions if you have them, but perhaps you don't have that kind of severe condition. But, and look, no, it's not uncommon for spices to be an irritant. I don't know, Pelly.
Yeah, certainly. I guess from a dietitian's and a nutritional point of view, I'd be looking at what's causing the possible indigestion, and maybe if you haven't already gone, go and speak to your GP. It could be a mechanical reflux or a pre-existing reflux that needs investigation or medication just to help you through that. Mm. The other things that can, I guess, cause a bit of indigestion is speed of eating. And that's one of the reasons, you know, why chewing foods is really important as well. And just keeping an eye on that as well.
All right, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Karen. Harry's on the line from Tweed Heads. Hi, Harry.
Yeah, g'day, guys. How you going?
Not bad.
Good.
Good.
So I'm an interstate truck driver. I don't have a fridge or anything in the truck here with me. It's pretty hard to eat good, so I'm stuck eating a lot of takeaway foods.
Yep.
And what I find is Macca's is always open through the night, different places you stop where nothing else is. How bad is it for you if, like, 95% of your diet, obviously I know it's not good, but if like 95% of your diet's all Maccas, and has been for a few years. How bad for it is you, and can it affect your mental health and that, like as we were talking about earlier?
Look, I think there's quite a strong evidence that what we call a typical Western-style diet, which is high in fat, high in salt, high in processed meats, and lacking in fibre, is not good for your health in general. Look, I mean, I don't know what foods you specifically eat at McDonald's. I mean, that's not to say that all foods at McDonald's are bad, and but certainly what you do consistently will have an impact on your health. You might be able to try some, you know, bananas and fruit, which, you know, probably don't need a lot of refrigeration and that kind of thing. Penny, you might have some advice on
that. Yeah, definitely. I guess it's a tough life on the road too, because you've got all these truck stops and, yeah, looking after hours for food, it can be hard. But I guess looking at the food choices at McDonald's, there are some options by adding extra salad when you go through the, if you're going in, just ask for extra salad or a side of salad. They can put extra foods on there. A lot of people don't know that. The other thing is, like Michael said, you know, just throwing things in a little bit of an esky, if you've got a little bit of a, dare I say, a six-pack esky, and just throw some fruit and even some tomatoes, just a punnet of tomatoes that keep really well in an esky when you're travelling, could be quite an easy benefit. But bananas is one of the key foods that is very high in resistant starch if it's actually picked at the right time. A good way to protect some of the, you know, if you're having to have some of these foods from McDonald's, it could be a way to protect a little bit of that.
Nuts are also a good handy thing to take
nuts
as well.
Nuts are good too, aren't they? Yeah.
Yep. Cashew.
How does that sound, Harry?
Something I could probably look at, I guess. Yep.
Sorry, Harry.
That's all good. Cheers.
Good luck, mate. Thanks.
Have a good night.
Yeah, you have a good night too. We have a great number of stick jockeys on the program, Penny and Michael, as you would imagine. A few calls, a few questions on the text line too. If I have honey with my yogurt, am I cancelling out the good effect of the yogurt?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, and when you say the good effect of the yogurt, I mean, a lot of people consume yogurts because they have probiotics within them. Mm. And so I wouldn't imagine that the honey would do anything to that. No, I think adding a bit of honey, there shouldn't be any negative benefits. Okay. So effects as far as I can see.
Can we talk about probiotics for a second?
Sure.
Fashionable these days too, isn't it? But people who are eating foods with which are said to be probiotic, that is, they are replacing or causing the gut to repopulate with the good bacteria. I mean, but yogurt's seen as one of those foods. How does that? What's the theory behind this, Penny?
I guess what they're saying with the probiotics is that it can help generate the positive bacteria, but what we've found with our research is really it's about the prebiotic, feeding the bacteria that's existing in your gut.
Rather than taking new stuff.
Yeah, and definitely it's beneficial. I mean, yogurt's fantastic. It's dairy, it's got calcium, and it's got dairy protein, which has got obviously very good benefits to health overall. So I wouldn't be saying, you know, stop that. But just looking at your fibre, that's really important. And having a prebiotic over a probiotic is what we'd probably be suggesting.
Mm. All right. Michael, what's the simplest and most user-friendly way to add fibre to your diet?
Oh, I mean, look, there's some in our book, as we suggest, there are certain food groups that I think you could incorporate into your breakfast, your lunch, your dinners. Certainly your whole grain foods, whole grain cereals,
right.
So your legumes.
So we eat whole grain bread, for example.
Whole grain bread. You know, a lot of your legumes, so your beans, are also a really good source of resistant starch. But also there's a reasonable amount of resistant starch that you can get from some of your starchy foods like your potato, your rice, and those type of foods, particularly if they've been heated and they've been allowed to cool again. That increases the amount of resistant starch in those foods. So there's actually quite a range of foods you can get resistant starch from. And bananas is another one we've mentioned. Slightly green is also a good source.
Well, it's a good source of fibre, banana.
Of resistant starch in particular, yeah.
Okay. All right. We're talking about gut health with Penny Taylor and Michael Conlon, from the CSIRO. Here's a slightly unpleasant topic. Heather, hello.
Oh, hello.
I'm glad you're raising this. I was going to raise it, but I was wondering how to do so. But you go. You go.
I've made it easy for you. Well, I happened to get that awful C. diff bug in my bowel through being given antibiotics and having it arthritis. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing in the end was to do this fecal transplant plant. Mm-hmm. It was the most amazing thing, and the hospital itself was so amazing, and it worked. But before you went on it, there was quite a procedure. You had to go on this very, very low fibre diet, which was exactly the opposite of what I've been usually eating, for about 6 weeks, plus antibiotics to try and kill the bug. And then the very day, very night you came home after having, you had one day and then something else, you know, the next day, you'd switched to a very high fibre diet. And when you came home, you were given, pamphlets and letters to say, tell you what to eat. And it was all really healthy food, and that's what you stay on, and that's what I've stayed on.
Mm.
But it was amazing, and it worked.
Yeah, okay. Michael and Penny, a fecal transplant is exactly what it sounds like. Is there evidence that it does work?
Yes, it absolutely
has in Heather's case, but...
Actually, the case you mentioned, the Clostridium difficile infection, now it's the fecal transplantation is successful in about 90% of cases. So, yes, that is probably the most common use for fecal transplantation.
So, in short, you're basically, what, transplanting someone else's gut, that lower bowel bacteria, into yours, is it?
That's right. You it varies how it's done, but, yes, certainly taking a pool of healthy poo, yeah, and transplanting it in hoping it takes hold in your gut and gets rid of the problem bacteria.
Hmm.
Yes, it was done sort of the first day, it was done as a colonoscopy,
mm-hmm,
and then you went back the very next morning and it was done as just as an enema. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing, you were never made to feel as if it was yicky or... Yep. Off, you know, they were so professional and so dedicated. It was just wonderful, you know, but it worked, and that was the main thing.
The main thing is it's worked, yeah.
Mm.
And how much better do you feel, Heather?
I feel much, it worked, and that was much better. I mean, it doesn't cure the ulcerative colitis, you've always got that, but it, you know, you just carry on as the doctor tells you to do. But I've been fine, you know, in that department, so that was really good. So, if anybody's ever, you know, pulling back from it, it was successful.
Yeah.
I was just going to add that we were involved, being involved in a study done in South Australia looking at fecal transplantation for ulcerative colitis. So, I mean, there was some limited success with that. So I think there is the option going forward to treat a whole range of different diseases.
Okay.
But I just wanted to assure people that
it doesn't have
frightened.
Don't be frightened. It might sound like a yuck factor, but that's not how it seems. No, that's not how it happens in practice.
No.
Thanks, Heather.
Okay.
Good on you.
Right, bye.
Bye-bye. Shane in Hobart. Hello, Shane.
Yeah, hi, guys. How are you doing?
Pretty well, thanks.
Yeah, just a question. I had, I was in hospital for 4.5 months. I had, unfortunately, contracted MRSA in hospital and VRE, and was on a tremendous amount of antibiotics for 4.5 months, or actually longer, 12 months. And I've had osteomyelitis in my foot, and I've had multiple amputations of my toes, and been on antibiotics once again, and I've had tremendous amount of problem with my gut through the antibiotics. My stool's been so runny. It's just starting to come right. But I always was under the impression that I needed probiotics. But I'm hearing you guys talk about prebiotics, which I've never heard of and I've never been spoken to about.
So the difference, so a probiotic is basically a live microorganism that you ingest, whereas a prebiotic is the food that you give to your gut that will stimulate the growth of the good bacteria that are present within your gut. So those prebiotics, things like resistant starch, but there's other common prebiotics called inulin, for example, but essentially if you can eat a range of different healthy fibres that will they have the effect of stimulating eventually the good bacteria, hopefully, that are present within your gut.
So what's the best way to go? Which is it, the probiotic or the prebiotic?
Look, I mean, there's certainly some people would still suggest that probiotics have a place, and they, and you know, if you feel as though they're having some benefit, you know, perhaps continue with that. But certainly a range of plant foods, and perhaps Penny can perhaps talk about that a little bit more as the dietitian. Penny?
Yeah, certainly. So really what I'll be adding in, and definitely, you know, your probiotics, I know with the antibiotics, especially after the hospital stay, are quite commonly promoted post, you know, intensive antibiotic treatment. So definitely listen to your GP if they've prescribed those to you. But definitely enhance your diet with things such as your legumes. Baked beans can be okay as well, just having something like that. Chickpeas, hummus, making a dip, having that with some vegetables. All those foods, even your whole grain breads and cereals, are foods that actually feed the good gut bacteria that are already pre-existing in your gut. So hopefully those antibiotics didn't knock everything out of your system, and you do have some good gut bacteria that need to be fed.
Okay then, guys, I appreciate that.
Right, Shane.
No worries.
Thank you. Bye. Pippa is on the line. Hello, Pippa.
Oh, hi. What a good subject. Can I ask you, cattle at Landline, I think, had a wonderful farmer up in Queensland who decided when he ran over his green banana on his farm one day, it turned up into a puff of flour. He's now manufacturing that and it's being sold. Now, would that be a resistant starch that you could add to your muesli in the morning?
It certainly is. So we know green bananas, you know, the furry ones, that when you eat it, they're not the best to eat, but the green banana contains a lot of the resistant starch. And finding that they're the highest in resistant starch, they've been made into the green banana flour that you're talking about. So most definitely adding a teaspoon or a tablespoon into your shake in the morning or sprinkling it on your cereal is a perfect way to increase your resistant starch.
And can I ask you also, I find that honey is also very soothing, particularly in winter with lemon. So it doesn't have any fibre in it, but it must assist the lining during the drier climate inside your home over winter.
That's an interesting statement because I'm not sure about the evidence around that, but I do know that, you know, a lot of people report that kind of benefit associated with honey. Definitely the taste is great too. So if it does give you that benefit, certainly don't stop it. You can still have the honey and enjoy that with the bit of lemon.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks, thanks, Pippa. Good on you. We're talking about the gut, so that means we can talk about all kinds of unpleasantnesses. John from Caulfield, hello.
Yes, good evening to you all. Some fascinating information here. Speaking of unpleasantness.
Yeah. I'm glad you're going to raise this, John, not me, but go on.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an embarrassing question, but sometimes after eating what seems to be quite healthy foods, vegetables, cabbages, Brussels sprouts, things like that, I suffer from bad smelly flatulence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if bad smelly flatulence is an indication of a good gut or a bad gut.
I think that's a good question, actually. What's the answer here, Penny or Michael? Is foul smelling flatulence good or bad?
Yeah. Well, I think everyone varies. I mean, as I've mentioned before, everyone's got a different gut microbiota, and so everyone's going to respond differently to different foods, including various fibres. I mean, it's a really hard one to say what's good and what's bad. I mean, most people will experience some gas or flatulence with some of those fermentable foods, but it's really hard to gauge the extent of the problem that you've got. I mean, we would always suggest that if people feel that they've got an issue, that one, they could always check with the GP, but also I don't know how much food you might have in one sitting. Perhaps just have smaller amounts of those foods, and you might find that over time it just takes time for your gut to adjust to some of those foods.
Penny? Right. Yeah.
And John, I'd probably be asking you, how severe is it? Does it feel uncomfortable? Are you finding that it's really quite impactful on your life and your quality of life? If that's the yes, then to you I'd say that's probably time to investigate that with your GP.
Okay,
There are some foods such as what you've named that have components in them that are poorly digestible by some people. It's called the FODMAPs, so the different types of carbohydrates and more carbohydrate-based sugars that some people just can't digest as well. So I would probably be looking into it if it becomes painful or impacts on your quality of life. But just to touch on what Michael said as well, we do know that if somebody has a moderate diet of fibre at each, say, at breakfast, lunch and dinner, you're having about 10 to 15 grams of fibre, but then on a occasion you may increase that dose to double. Your body doesn't cope with that as well as we might think it does, and that's where you can get excessive gas or bloating as well. So it might be an occasional experience, and that's, then we would say, you know, that's okay. But if it's a regular occurrence for you, I'd be definitely seeking some support.
Okay.
Right, okay, yeah. Yeah, thanks very much.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm fortunate that the other people, other staff in my office, they're quite understandable and, you know, they're nice people.
That's yeah, you're going to have to take in some roses.
long suffering, John.
Okay.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Cheers to you too. We're talking with gut health experts Penny Taylor and Michael Conlon about the CSIRO Healthy Gut Diet book, which is out now to improve your gut health. Just back to some more text. Is there any evidence that some alcohol, such as red wine, is good for your gut? Michael?
The stance at the moment, most people are saying that zero alcohol is good, and I'm not sure. Policy changes with time. Look, I mean, there are some potentially good things in red wine. It has a compound called resveratrol, which is a well-known antioxidant, or polyphenol, and polyphenols have been shown to have some benefits. But that's obviously countered by the fact you've got alcohol present. I think the jury's out. Drink in moderation.
I think it look at why you're drinking the red wine. If you're having one glass every other night and you're having two alcohol-free nights, it's you know, it's considered healthy. But if it helps you relax and reduce your stress, and as Michael touched on earlier, stress is a factor that can cause a disruption in your gut or an unhealthier gut. If it's helping you reduce your stress, it could be beneficial.
Okay. All right, John, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Not bad, John.
Good. My question was that I read once that depending on your blood type, depends on what your diet should consist of. And there was a list of things that for my particular blood type that it was saying I could and couldn't eat, and actually wiped out nearly everything I liked, to be quite honest with you. But I just want to know if there's any truth in that. I mean, and I'm not talking an unhealthy diet, I'm talking things like it was suggesting I shouldn't eat, well, the only meat I should eat is chicken. Every other piece of meat was not good for me. And fruits, you know, things like mangoes and things like which I really liked, now I believe that that you shouldn't eat them. So I'm wondering, is there truth to your blood type suggesting what your diet should be?
Sure. I know this book. It's the blood type book. It was brought out around about 15 years ago. And it caused a bit of stir at the time. But look, the evidence is quite weak in that area. We're definitely not at that type where we can look at your blood and actually determine the foods that you should be eating for your blood type. In a few more years with DNA testing and a whole range of testing, who knows?
But in short, don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Well, that's good because I have it. Thanks so much.
On you, John.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Yes. Peter from Holsworthy, hello. G'day,
Peter. Hey, mate, how are you going?
Not bad.
I was just ringing up. I get like a extra amount of gas and things in my system, depending on even if I eat healthy or not healthy. I'm just wondering how you can control the gas in your stomach. Hmm. Any suggestions?
Well, I mean, I guess it could be you could try eliminating certain foods. I mean, I guess I don't know whether you're having any gassy foods like Coke or beer or
no, kind
of things. No, no.
Yeah, I've suffered with like irritable bowel kind of thing. I spoke to my GP and the medication he gave me, Isomatic or something like that.
Right.
And it didn't really work. It just clogged me up.
I probably can add a bit of a comment there. If you've been diagnosed with irritable bowel, so a colonoscopy, which actually looks at the bowel and looks at inflammation of the bowel, can actually pick up if it's inflamed. And you get basically the symptoms of irritable bowel increase, bloating, gas, distension. But stool frequency can change from loose to firm on a drop of a hat, and not quite often, depending on what you're eating, like you described. That does sound like you're having some intolerances, or definitely with IBS, it has some intolerance to those foods I've mentioned before under the FODMAP range. So if you speak to your GP and get your support from a practicing dietitian in that space, they can help you pick out the foods that will be causing that. They can take you through a personal challenge that will suit you.
Mm. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for that.
Oh, that's okay. I hope that's helpful. If beer is a fermented food, is that good for you?
Oh, I'm looking for that answer.
Well, people have suggested that beer does have some health benefits.
It's fermented, isn't it?
It is fermented. It's... I think we'll take that as a fermented food, but it has alcohol in it, so you've got to be aware of the fact that it's an alcohol product. But there are dissolved nutrients and other components to the beer that can also benefit your health.
Terry texts saying, is porridge good for fibre? I suspect it is it?
Porridge is amazing for fibre. It comes from the oat family, so it's got the beta-glucans and soluble and insoluble fibre, so enjoy your oats.
Yeah, I like your oats. Nathan says, how many nuts is healthy per day? Too many, not good for you.
Yeah, too many. I mean, nuts have a lot of fatty oils in it, healthy fats, I must add, and fibre in them as well. So, but we do know, eating excess energy from any foods is not very good for you. So just keeping a moderate serve around about 30 to 40 grams a day would be quite beneficial.
Mm. Unsalted. Yeah.
Unsalted. Mm. Oops.
What are the...
Have them roasted.
Yeah, I had a number of texts tonight too. In fact, I think we've got a couple of callers who want to know the answer to this is... Look, what's the quick takeaway from all of this? Obviously, most people don't want to go on a complete rebuild of their diet, but if we're just trying to improve our gut health, what are the quick things that we ought to be doing?
Yeah, that's great, because that's the, I guess, the point of why we brought the book out. We want to keep the message quite simple and not complicated.
Yeah.
The key message really is we need to feed our gut. We need to feed our gut healthy foods, and most of us know what those foods are. We know that taking out the indulgence foods, minimising the alcohol, reducing the salt in our diet is really quite common knowledge. But what we do need to do in Australia, like I said, we're only getting about 20 grams of fibre a day. We need to boost our fibre. We need to add around about 5 to 10 grams of fibre a day.
So we should be having what? 30 grams a day, should we?
We should be having about 30 grams of total fibre a day.
Well, what does that actually mean? Describe what 30 grams of fibre looks like, for example.
Yeah, that's really hard. But I guess if you have a look in...
One slice of bread, one banana?
Well, one banana would have probably about 3 to 5 grams of fibre in it.
Right.
A bowl of cereal. So in the book, we've got some sample meal plans, and in our recipes we've got fibre flags, because we know fibre, or describing fibre as far as a volume is concerned, is really different, because every food has a different amount of fibre in it. But just as a rough guide, so that porridge that we were talking about earlier, even if you had an Uncle Toby's Aunt Sachet, you're looking at around about 3 to 5 grams of fibre in that.
What about people who like eggs for breakfast? If they had it on two slices of wholemeal toast,
whole grain would be much, much better. There's no fibre in eggs, but in the bread themselves, the more grains that you can see, the better. And definitely having two slices of that, you probably boost that. And having some vegetables to the side, some spinach and some mushroom as well, is really quite important. That would probably boost it to around about 10 grams of fibre in that meal.
Tony from Wangaratta says, what do you think of a tablespoon of psyllium husk with cereal or porridge every morning?
Most definitely. That's a really great way of actually boosting that fibre into that diet. So sometimes we don't have time to prepare those vegetables all the time, and psyllium husk is one of those quick additionals that you can put in.
Okay. All right, look, sadly we've run out of time. It's been a pleasure having both of you on. Penny Taylor and Michael Condon have both been with us for the CSIRO Healthy Gut Diet book. It's out now. A lot of good common sense in it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for the texts.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.